baba funa sa anyuka wabute amunyeko baba funa sa ayanu hagari funa numa amunyeko baba funa sa aruma hanuma o amunyeko baba funa sa adugraha wawu amunyeke chulu halita lulare ida ho chulu halita lularu fuda ho chulu halita lulare ida ho bedi wanyali e Anyagawa bute amunyeke Gaba funasa ayanu hagari funa numa amunyeke Gaba funasa aruma hanuma o amunyeke Gaba funasa adugraha wa o amunyeke
That's Andy Palacio, a proponent of Garifuna culture, very much so. In fact, he was like a saint. He died some years ago, and thousands turned up for his funeral, because not only was he a proponent of the language and the customs, but also the traditions of Garifuna. The Garifuna people were brought, enslaved from Africa and brought to the Caribbean, specifically the island of St. Kitts, all the way back in the 1600s. And then when it was appearing that they were merging with the local Amerindian culture, they were moved to South America. And again, of course, repeated the practice, but the intent was to sever the ties, but instead they grew stronger. So Andy Palacio encouraged the country to adopt or to revisit and to rekindle the culture, the Garifuna culture, which is now a combination of the Amerindian culture, the African culture, and some of the African, French, and Spanish culture. He was very much revered for that. So I honor him and think about him today. He's one of my favorites. I love the Garifuna music. I don't know the language, but it is an extraordinary culture, and I'm trying to get a thing or two. I know some Garifuna people from Brooklyn for many years now, but I haven't yet immersed myself in the language, but certainly other aspects of the culture. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it's Free Your Mind Friday. What do we do on Free Your Mind Friday? For those of you joining us for the first time, well, we take on the issues of the day or any other topic that we choose with the intention of offering a different point of view. And, of course, we prove or disprove, depending which way you want to go, the points that you think ought to be considered. So we do that by calling 888-874-4888, and you speak your truth. Hopefully, it can be as concise as you possibly can, because we usually have so many people waiting to talk. And that's the fun of Free Your Mind Friday, that people look forward to expressing their views in a way that they don't have normally, even though I would say that one of the signature marks of the show is that I really, really enjoy hearing people think out loud. It is not important whether people agree or disagree. It is important that we appreciate a different point of view. And if you want to offer a counter to that, all the more exciting. So 888-874-4888 is the number to call. Maat is first, up at bat. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, greetings, Hotep, beloved family.
Thank you.
Yes, I wasn't able to. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, I wasn't able to get through, but I want to very briefly deal with a previous subject, and that I concur with your analysis around Congress women Maxine Waters and I guess it's the Senator Pelosi.
She's a member of Congress. She is, in fact, also, a leader in the Congress,
yes,
Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah, she was a speaker at one point. Waters seemed to feel we need to get her a memo. She seemed to feel she needed to go out on a limb and investigate to impeach Trump around the Russian possible Russian or alleged Russian hacking. But I think that she needs to just deal with the in-your-face incompetence and racism. And Pelosi, she made a statement around Bannon being put as a principal of the National Security Council, and she referred to him as the white supremacist he is, you know, trying to push for a race war allied with editor Breitbart. But when he was made chief strategist, where was her pointing out, because that means that black folks and people of color and the poor are going to exponentially, and with this session fellow, exponentially be beat upside the head and killed and maimed and put in their gulags on and on. But the main point I want to make today is a point that I put when I had the opportunity in December. It caused a lot of flurry during the Nation cruise, and we did go to Honduras, and I met some delightful Garifuna children. But in one of the sessions, the panel sessions, I tried to make the point that we need to begin to think of September 11, 2001, as the Reichstag fire of the U.S., especially since we're staring down a blatant type of a neo-fascism. And the point that I'm trying to make is that we can take baby steps, because part of the problem is the psychology of understanding what is the biggest lie that we can't quite face, but resulted in perpetual global warfare, drone attacks, loss of civil liberties. I mean, the Patriot Act was on the shelf and brought down and on. So, you know, people at dinner would say to me, what did I mean about considering it the Reichstag fire now that we're dealing with this, the Don, as Gary puts it? It's because the collective consciousness at some level understands that that's a big lie. So even if we do it quietly and look at Dr. Judy Wood's work as a starter and see that she gives us some way to go beyond not saying that we understand fifth grade science. She actually gives us a way for any situation as to how you look at evidence and how you make determinations. And I'm going to let some other callers get in, but that's something. And Dr. Ray Griffin, David Ray Griffin, he actually deals with the psychology of why we can't see fifth grade science, why we can't see the big lie and continuing. And Trump, of course, is someone who's going to be the most unconscious around what really happened September 11th, 2001. There's another September 11th, and that's what was done to Allende out of Chile. So I'll and Dr. Kevin Barrett, who also analyzes and looks at potential other false flags. Trevor Aronson did a book called Terror Factory, as to how the FBI actually creates terrorism by, you know, coercing informants who actually create a plot where people don't have a plug nickel. It was a big Newberg case. So that's my last point. And listen to the beloved family. Thank you.
Thank you so much for calling in and getting us started today. 888-874-4888, Connecticut. Gabriel, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you doing?
Okay. How are you?
Can you hear me? Can you hear me clearly? Is it any feedback?
Yes, I can a little bit. We're getting a little bit of feedback, but it's fine. It's bearable.
Okay. Let me get. Is this better?
I don't know. I'll ask the engineer. On my end, it's bearable. We can
okay.
Work with it.
Okay. Well, I'd like to say that there's something into the notion. Or the initiative of having maybe one day, or perhaps a week, or if not a week, one day, where you hear discussions of people of different ethnic backgrounds who are considered the so-called minorities, and their experience working in the private sector in the job workforce, and how they have been experiencing derogatory behavior, rude comments and conducts from their white Anglo-Saxon Protestant co-workers on this Trump trauma or the Trump victory. It's something very telling. I've experienced, and I've had secondhand experience and third-party experience of friends who have had these gross, inappropriate, rude, ill-mannered behavior from coworkers, talking in behind or in front of the water cooler, if you will, at these 9-to-5 jobs, where you are constantly the brunt of a joke. Are you constantly being reminded of your so-called subservient status, which is all a myth? And I think maybe one day, perhaps one week, a conversation where people call in who are Mexican, who are indigenous, or who are so-called African-Americans who have been misclassified African-Americans who are indigenous to this land, and those others who have been marginalized and disenfranchised, but who've actually excelled in high school, who've actually excelled in college, and were given the chance to work in a 9-to-5 private sector job, but still have experienced harassments. That's just a footnote, what I have to say, but I just want your feedback on that, if that's a possible project or initiative.
Well, I think my initial reaction is that after about 2 or 3 days of that, you're ready to open the window and jump through it. You know, you just get report after report after report. I would prefer doing more of what we're doing now, which is talking, and not just in one through one channel or one means of communicating things, but let it just ride. You know, let's see where it goes. But talking, I don't think it would be too much of a stretch of the imagination to an audience that in the workplace you have such insane things going on. But to just do it alone as a one-track kind of conversation, I think it would get a little bit boring after a while. I prefer to have it as part of the mix of our conversation, you know?
Yeah.
I can't, you know, I it's an important subject, but it's like anything else. If all we talk is about, you know, just one subject and variations on the same theme, you could get tired of that pretty fast.
Well, I understand that. That's a very good point. But my main point is this: you were talking about how Hillary Clinton will hijack or move her Democratic Party to white women or white Anglo-Saxon women or Catholic women and all those who are non-black or non-ethnic women, and try to galvanize another effort for an election bid, a presidential bid. I would have to say that the Women's March, with the exception of a few speakers, Ashley Judd and the others, these women have seemed to have a cognitive dissonance, or the LGB community. The LGB community, our Jewish friends and our white female friends, on the progressive aisle when it comes to the assassination of black people in the streets. Where were they? I mean, when it comes to disenfranchisement in the workplace, where they dismiss or marginalize and do not accept people of color, African-Americans, so-called African-Americans, women of color, Mexicans who've been in this country for generations upon generations. I think they're very spoiled, and that if Hillary Clinton wishes to take the Democratic Party and hijack it and bring on a new feminism, so to speak, we have to keep in mind that they constantly have marginalized women of color's voices, let alone black men, let alone minority men, so-called minority men. So when you talk about how she will make this initiative, she has no credibility to do so. She has lost credibility for a great deal of time. In fact, both parties have lost credibility. How many times can you have a political agenda where it doesn't see any fruits of its labor? It doesn't see any fruits of those who have gone out, picketed, protest, supported the candidate, trumped for the candidate, thumped out for voting, registered the voters, and they feel disenfranchised and marginalized and disappointed. It seems that there's a cognitive dissonance among those who are also helping to navigate a Hillary Clinton presidential bid, when they know it's not going to have any type of fruits of their labor for any education system, reconstruction of the job market, relief of taxes, health care, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, putting a dog muzzle on our criminal justice system and a dog muzzle on our political police state.
Well, this is part of the changes that people must consider. However, the nature of activism is that a whole bunch of people would appear to be riding along with you, but they're not necessarily in the fight. And you have to accept that as, in the way that you accept basic human behavior. Basic human behavior is not as idealistic as you just laid out. Basic human nature, especially in the United States, is to take advantage wherever you can find it. And it's very, very, one-sided thing. Now, I would tell you that I suspect that most of the women who showed up for the Women's March on Washington were very sincere, but sincere also within their own life experience and their own definition of sincerity. You would notice that Hillary Clinton wasn't on site in any of those marches, but she did issue a note of support. That's as far as she was prepared to go. She is not prepared at this stage to really get down to the nitty-gritty. She is prepared to go as far as she needs to go to get what she wants. It has nothing more than that. There's nothing, no greater commitment other than just that. So the other side of the coin is people, even with all sincerity, they are being shaped, their beliefs are being shaped to a large degree by the media, not the general media, the media that serves these communities. They're not taking on the issues, they're not educating people about in that particular arena, they're not particularly educating them about the issues. They're reporting, and they're reporting according to the standards of the general media. So we have lost a lot also in that arena, because people have moved away in the media from the idea that the media should serve a particular need. They are basically being told what to write, how to write it, what you should say. That does not happen with my program on PRN, but I can assure you, in the so-called liberal media, it happens every day. So there's very little tolerance for disagreement. They want you to think exactly as the leadership thinks. Do exactly what they tell you to do, because you don't have a mind of your own. You have to be told what to do. They want to make judgments about whether you actually belong in that group, because you may have a different point of view with respect to your own personal ideology. So
we have a lot of stuff to correct here. We got to exit. We have to exit those who are, have proper minds, the Utrecht Lees of the world, the Gary Knowles of the world, those of that type of caliber who follow that type of caliber of convictions, have to remove ourselves and make our own self-eviction from this type of comfort zone, if you will, the comfort zone of not disturbing the apple cart, where these individuals who have been on the high tier level, the positions of authority making decisions, they are in the positions of authority making decisions for a great period of time upon generation or generation, must leave their post. They must leave because we as people of different ethnic backgrounds, and those who are progressively white Anglo-Saxon Protestants or Catholics or of the Jewish community have been tinkering around and jockeying for positions, and some have been stopgapping and preventing other ethnic groups from progressing or advancing for prosperity in the American dream. Our white Anglo-Protestants, our Jewish community are the perfect example of that, of stopgapping and preventing those of other ethnic backgrounds from moving ahead with capital, with loans, with jobs, with gainful employment, and things of that sort. So I would have to say that they have no credibility, and they do not deserve or require, or we do not deserve, we do not require their acceptance or their approval as we move forward to having a separate political party and agenda. And if we hijack the Democratic Party or the Green Party, then so be it. That's the evolution of progress, not the reverse.
Could you think of a time when the issue that you laid out and the way you laid it out, in your mind, is there a time in U.S. history that it happened? That
yes.
People
resisted yes.
the brutal majority, even within radical and liberal movements?
Right. There have been several times in the American experience of non-monarch British king or queen rule during the founding of our fathers. Case in point, the Articles of Confederation during Philadelphia before the 13 colonies became the United States. It was so. However, the Masons and the Jesuits of that time oppressed and hijacked the agenda for progressive movements for all of humanity, all colors, to be able to have commerce and work within the 13 colonies or within the burgeonings of the United States government. Let's go back, fast forward to the Goldwater situation, where in Goldwater and all those situations where in 1930s there was situations where the suffrage movement was blooming and the socialist movement was blooming. However, you had different corporations at that time: J.P. Morgan, Stanley, the Ford, the Rockefellers, and the Rothschilds, who hijacked through their Tavis Stock Institute agenda to hijack those movements. Fast forward now, we have the in 1980s we had the so-called Rainbow Coalition, where blacks were misclassified once again as African American by Jesse Jackson. This was a very pivotal point where we had a movement that took place where once again it was hijacked by our hierarchy of those in position of power and authority, the white Anglo-Saxons and the Jews, who took it over and made it something for their own purpose and agenda.
I disagree with you on the Rainbow Coalition because I was there and witnessed it and seemed to be the only person reporting it.
It was a big joke.
where Jackson came to town and just took it. They had a convention. He just took it. And the people who should have fought back did nothing. Did absolutely nothing. They let him have it. Same like Bernie Sanders. The people in the Sanders movement still haven't called him to task, still haven't called him out, still haven't rebuked him. They let him have it.
I totally agree with you.
They let him have it.
I agree with you.
See, so it's a two-way street. It is also the fact that movements routinely are co-opted, the leadership and the membership co-opted in different ways. And that is how movements, even ones that are desperately needed, get, you know, they become victims of all kinds of attacks, the main objective being to destroy them. But they let it happen. So the membership, I blame the membership. I blame the membership of the Green Party, which has done nothing to call to account the leadership of the Green Party. They still have not asked publicly, or they still have not held any kind of meeting to discuss publicly what happened. So it is not the leadership. The leadership, of course, we know, has a principal responsibility here. But the membership usually does nothing. They sit by the side and they allow these atrocities to occur and then repeat them until somebody says, okay, we can't keep repeating these cycles and expecting progress. We have to confront our internal contradictions. That is the necessary part of the work. But I'm still waiting. I'm still counting. I'm waiting to see when the Green Party leadership and membership will come together in some kind of a formal way to assess, to give a report on the performance of this party, where it went right, where it went wrong, what it needs to do. Is it even continuing? We don't know. It's awful, but that's the way things develop. Thanks so much for your call today. I really appreciate it. Let's go to Michigan. I see Leona, you're on the air.
Hi, Yatrice. God bless you, and hello to your PRN audience.
Thank you. Hello. How are you?
I'm good, thank you, ma'am. Listen, I was calling because I just wanted to express a quick opinion about the show for February 8th, the show you did on Betsy DeVos and the meaning of freedom and the people
yes.
survey. Yeah, and your guests, among your guests was Tom Pedroni out of Detroit and Mrs.
Yes.
M. Denise Baldwin and Russ Ballant. Based on my opinion, based on my knowledge of the fight for constructive public education for our children in Detroit, the majority of whom are descendants of enslaved Africans in the USA, and with all due respect to Ms. M. Denise Baldwin, it's my humble opinion that Mrs. Helen Moore, ought to be considered.
Oh, I know Helen Moore. She's been on the program a couple of times, yes.
Okay, good. Well, the show description on the PRN website, show archives website, says it says that M. Denise Baldwin is, quote, the lead voice against school closures and lead defender of public education in the state of Michigan. Again, with all due respect to Ms. Baldwin, who I don't know, it's just based on my knowledge and me
but
watching.
But she's basically, she's based in Saginaw.
Yes, ma'am. Right. I saw that.
And yes. So yeah, I thought yeah. I would kind of give, I take your observation and maybe I need to just revise it. But in fact, Denise is a leading voice, just like Helen Moore
okay.
is. These okay. are some fierce women.
Yes,
and they've been involved.
Yes,
Elena Herrada, very, very
yes.
vital to the community. What we were trying to get was that we had that small group because they were literally at the moment we were speaking, involved in meetings, planning meetings with the objective of taking on this administration in education. And because Michigan is a state that we have concentrated on for so long, getting all these different voices to verify that the attack on the state, and especially the predominantly black cities of Michigan, which is just about every city, but that this, we talked about Detroit in specific as an example of what was coming nationwide. You know, the systematic destruction of the city, the massive unemployment, the reduction in opportunities for people of color, but not just people of color. But the reason that we chose Detroit, all these different cities in Detroit, was I was claiming, I don't know if you were listening at that time, but I kept saying, we have to, Detroit is the case study in a national project to depopulate all major black cities and to put into play what we're seeing now going on in Chicago, the militarization and the federalization of troops. We saw this in Detroit. We saw it in many of the cities in Michigan. So that's why I put them together, because they each had just come from planning meetings, and that's the only reason.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it was a great show. I watched it. I thought, I mean, not watched it. I listened to it, and it was very informative, and I couldn't help but wonder, well, where's Helen Moore? How come she's not on this show?
I am a big fan of Helen Moore. Big fan.
Yes, ma'am, I am too. And I had called her to find out, you know, had she been invited or whatever. She said, well, she was just left a protest, and they think they have a warrant out for her arrest.
That's one of the things that happened on that day.
Yes, ma'am.
There were so many things connected to education happening on that day. And frankly, it was a little rough getting people together on that day, because they were literally just coming out of meetings or just about to go into one. So I was lucky to even get all three together.
Oh, thank you for doing that. Thank you for pulling that together. I'm glad that you were able to do that show. And since I've called in, I guess maybe you could just ignore that email that I sent a few minutes ago. It was about the same thing. But now I have a wider lens of what happened. I just wanted to call in to say that. Yeah.
Well, you know, we're going to be on it with the education aspect, because this is something very, very close to so many people's hearts. And again, I say this as noting how unfortunate it is that we should be discussing this, Detroit and Saginaw and Flint and all these other cities in Michigan, in order to tell people, to sound the clarion call, that the reason we have to pay attention to these things as they unfold is that they are the prototype for a national program, for national programs.
Yes.
We have to watch them. So thanks so much for calling
in. Thank you.
Jose from Rosedale, you're on the air.
Greetings, my professor. How are you?
How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm well. Thank you. And as always, ancestral blessings be upon you. Always.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. And same to you.
Now, I have two quick topics here. The first one, I must ask your permission, if it is all right, to make a community announcement.
Sure. Go ahead.
Well, our little organization, the Sons and Daughters of Jamaica, is having our annual Black/African History Month celebration at Medgar Evers College in Brooklyn. and it's going to be held in the in the Edison O. Jackson Auditorium at 1650 Bedford Avenue in Brooklyn. And it's going to be held Friday, February 17th at 5 p.m. We'll begin by screening a documentary on the life of the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey. And it is really a very good documentary on the Garvey movement. And we'll have some of the folks discussing, our scholars and our Garvey are discussing the Garvey era. And
okay.
So, and then we'll have other presenters
and just support. Give us the day and the time.
Okay. It's Friday, February 17th. Starting at 5 p.m., and it's going to be at Medgar Evers College in Brooklyn in the Edison O. Jackson Auditorium, 1650 Bedford Avenue. And I hope everyone turn out because it's going to be a very enlightening evening, okay?
All right.
And thank you. And the next and last topic is a few days ago, I went to Hostos Community College in the Bronx. And for an event there, and I picked up a flyer, right? And the flyer announced an event that was supposed to be taking place there yesterday, but I assume that it was snowed out. This is about, I don't know what I did with the flyer. I'm having all these senior moments. But it was about a Jewish group that is honoring the Dominican government and Dominican people for rescuing some of the Jewish people, victims of the Hitler's Nazi terror in Germany. Because some of the ships came around this part of the world, and they were turned back. But I think it was Raphael Trujillo at the time,
Trujillo,
was president,
yes.
And he took in a few thousand of the Jewish people, and offered them land and other assistance. And I remember reading the article. It was kind of ironic that there was a agricultural specialist of Palestinian extraction who helped them to develop to farming and things like that and so forth. And they have grown to become prosperous and those things and so forth. And so they are recognizing the government for what they have done for them and so on and so forth. But moving backwards, some time ago, my professor, I was reading this article in one of the local newspapers in Brooklyn. One of those things that want to act as if they're a newspaper. But you and I, you know, when they read your paper, then they'll know what the newspaper is all about. And it told a story, the same story, about what Trujillo and the Dominican people have done for the Jewish people. And then I remember that it was during that same period that the government of the Dominican Republic and the people, much of the people of the Dominican Republic, the things that they were doing to African people and those especially of the of Haitian background and so forth. Thousands of Haitians were slaughtered. Women had to run and leave their children, and there were rapes and murders, and many thousands was pushed over the border between the Dominican Republic and Haiti. It was one of the world's most tragic moments in history. And I said, how could that be? Why this guy and the people of Dominican Republic is destroying so many human beings' lives? They are accepting the Jewish people in. But Trujillo said he wanted to whiten the Dominican Republic. And so I called up the consulate of the Dominican Republic, and I told him about the story, and I said, because the papers, the story said that they were supposed to give the awards at the consulate, the Dominican consulate in New York City. And I called him up because I wanted to be there to point out this what happened. And so They hurriedly and told me, no, we know nothing about that. It's not happening here and so on and so forth. But they mentioned that this councilman at the time, the first councilman of Dominican ancestry, I forgot his name. Well, he, at the time, he was out of office, I think he was term limited. He was during the Bloomberg administration, I think Bloomberg's first term or somewhere around there. And it happened, so happened that the next week, I ran into him at an event in Bronx Borough Hall, in a Brooklyn Borough Hall. And I called him over, and I was pointing out this story to him, and I told him that I'm writing a letter, and I would like for him to present it to the government of the Dominican Republic, the same way he's taking all these things from the Jewish community to give it to the government of the Dominican Republic. I would like you to take my letter and hand it to him also. And he told me now that he's not an emissary of the government. And so I said, but how can you take their awards and so forth and give, well, you can't take mine. And at the moment, someone called him, and he hurriedly ran away and never came back to me. So I am pointing this what is happening in our as a people. We see all these things are happening, and no, we're not questioning these things. They're coming right there into Hustlers Community College, and I'm sure no one is going to be there to question what has been done to the Haitian people. And there's been no apology and nothing from the government, nothing. And they're here now, and Donald and Trump is getting ready to do it to all of us. And they are the ones that, to this point, is still pushing and destroying the lives of African people, especially those of Haitian extraction. And they see now that this president here is going to do it to all of us, not just to Haitian people of Haitian background, but they also, because many Dominicans are here in this country and they're not legal. And so, you know, it is frustrating. But I hope, my professor, you can comment a little bit on what I've said, because you know how to put my frustration into perspective.
This tension in the Caribbean, it's very subtle in some areas and blatant in others. Mm-hmm. The tensions in the Caribbean, especially the Dominican Republic, people, of course, because it's been only recently in the media, we may have some familiarity with it, but this issue of the Dominican Republic and Haiti, the relationship between two or lack thereof, this is a major point of contention. Mm-hmm. Just recently, as you know, the enactment of the law that Haitians who are in the Dominican Republic, born in the Dominican Republic, who are the descendants several generations in the Dominican Republic, being denied citizenship there and mm-hmm. forced back across the border, even if they have no connection, have had no connection for generations mm-hmm. with Haiti. That's a major point of contention. But it's only in the most recent explosion. Mm-hmm. We've had lynchings going on in the Dominican Republic of Haitians. Yes. That's been going on for quite some time. We have had the question of race and color, especially in the Dominican Republic. Who was that ball player who even lightened his skin and changed the color of his eyes and became something of a laughing stock? His name skips me now.
Is it Sosa? But,
I'm sorry?
Is it Sosa?
Sosa, that's it.
Yes.
Sammy Sosa.
Yes.
This is a major, major obsession mm-hmm. in ways that even in the Caribbean, we are amazed by it.
Yes.
This idea of called mejorar la raza, meaning you improve the race by getting all that melanin out. It should be noted that the oldest synagogues in that region are in Jamaica and in Trinidad. The Jews have a pretty long presence in the region. principally mm-hmm. as the insurers of slave ships. They mm-hmm. were very, very active in the slave trade. And they financed the slave trade in the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
We are coming in after centuries of this kind of arrangement. For example, I was on, I did a program on Channel 13 in New York called Informed Sources, and one program, the guest was Elie Wiesel,
mm-hmm.
The late Elie Wiesel, who was a major proponent, an advocate for people who suffered or descended from people who were slaughtered in the Holocaust. I asked him, mm-hmm. point blank, face to face, I said, would you consider the annihilation of the First Nations people of the United States, the Africans who were brought here, the natives in the Caribbean, because I, you know, made it known that of that Jewish connection with the mm-hmm. synagogues, which exist to this day. Would you call the attacks, the systematic attacks, the prolonged attacks that wiped out so many millions of people? My friend Jan Carew said that within 20 years of the arrival of Columbus,
mm-hmm.
the population of the region was reduced by 80%.
Wow.
The indigenous population. So I asked him, would he consider these holocausts? And he said, no. I said, then what would make the Holocaust in Europe a Holocaust, and a Holocaust in the Caribbean, and a Holocaust in the United States, and a Holocaust in Africa, not Holocaust? And he refused to answer the question.
The victims have to be Jewish.
Well, this, not only that, it's the purloining of the word, where people say, well, these are just, as you said, that the Jews of in Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what is known as Israel today is Palestine.
Yes.
Okay. So, but it's the same thing with the Dominican Republic. They would not, simply because, well, the Spanish essentially got the people of the Dominican Republic under their rule,
mm-hmm.
they make a difference and a differentiation to say they are not African.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are Amerindian and an admixture of Amerindians and Spanish, anything. And we could see, them. In fact, the Dominicans were the reason that the Bureau of the Census recategorized them,
mm-hmm.
because back in the day, if you had a Spanish surname, you automatically were white.
Yes.
Until they looked at Dominicans and said, oops, we have to reconfigure this. We have to rethink this. And then they developed a separate category.
Yes.
But if you read the book White by Law, this was a very interesting case mm-hmm. that they studied, Supreme Court cases that allowed the U.S. Bureau of the Census to change that rule. If you were Arab, you were white.
Mm-hmm.
If you were Asian, you were white. So we have some really interesting history in terms of who is white and who is not. When it comes to Jews,
mm-hmm.
we had a recent development in which, and even now it's raging, because even among Jews, there is a discussion about who is a Jew.
Yes.
Are you a Jew because you have a Jewish last name? Or are you a Jew because you proclaim yourself to be Jewish? There are many Jews
mm-hmm.
who, because they do not embrace the tenets of Judaism, are declassified
mm-hmm.
based on the fact that they do not hold to the tenets of Judaism. They're non-practicing Jews. So they just throw them out.
Yes.
And they become white. There was a time when Jews are not automatically white.
Yes.
And this is a big question. Would you believe this is a huge question? Now, in Israel itself, as they seek to purify the race and reclassify the race as to who is a Jew, Jews who are intermarried are no longer Jews. Jews who are non-European, remember that not too long ago, I think just about 20 years or so ago, they started the process of reclassification. The original Jews were thrown out.
Yes.
And they were forced to reconvert under the rabbinical laws that currently exist in Israel today. Although their claims of Judaism, of being Jews, I'm talking now about people from Ethiopia and the African region that had long been practicing Jews, the Ashkenazis have taken hold of this religion, everything.
Yes.
They have resettled the land. They came from all these different parts of Europe, and they said Palestine, where historically all these different sects lived together in pretty good harmony, I would say.
Yes.
They all were in Palestine. There was no problem until the Ashkenazis and the European Jews decided this is going to be our land. And that's the narrative that was developed to justify the occupation of Palestine. So we've got a lot of this still unresolved. And what you witnessed in Brooklyn is merely a reflection of this argument that has been going on now for hundreds of years.
Yes.
And, of course, with respect to Israel, it has become more and more intense as the Zionists take hold of more and more land. They just finished building or getting ready to build 6,000, I think, 6,000 more units of housing in total violation of the law. So we still have in the Caribbean a more muted struggle.
Yes.
But look how long it has persisted. As I said, the oldest temples.
Yeah.
The oldest ones are right there in Jamaica. In fact, my friend, a very, very dear friend of mine, whose entire lineage is Ethiopian, and they would go to temple in the mosque in Jamaica. The temple in Jamaica.
Temple.
The synagogues.
Yes.
So this is a chord of history I don't think we give enough attention to.
No.
The involvement of Jews way before the Holocaust. But the involvement of Jews in the slave trade, and both in Europe and in the Caribbean.
And my professor, that money is still at work in the Caribbean.
Well, everything that derived a stream of revenue with respect to the slave trade is still alive everywhere you go. Do you know, I went to the work camps in Europe, and to my amazement, I saw records listing Haitian doctors. You see these things that are anomalies that still say that people who really, really identified with the inhumanity of the situation, mobilized themselves from all corners of the world to fight it. You see people from blacks from Europe, blacks from Africa, Haitian doctors going to help. You have African Americans, many of them, going to help the soldiers who were killed there.
Yes.
But you practically have to go there to see it in order to get some historical reference on it. Thanks so much. We've come to the end of our program today. It's the weekend. Surround yourselves with very positive people. And thanks for joining me today. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Alternative Visions with Dr. Jack Rasmus. See you Monday. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.